You are about to enter the pop, pulp, and subcultural minds of several individuals. What may leak into the ether can sometimes be too strange, too confusing for the average human mind. When nerds assemble.
Hello and welcome to episode 15 of the Nerds Assemble podcast. I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
I'm Paul, aka Cookie.
And I'm Paul, aka Retroid.
And today we are joined by one Mr. Peter Cooper. Do you want to say
hello?
Hello.
Hi. Peter is the writer for the Telecost Protocol comics, which are being published by Vanquish Interactive after being funded through a Kickstarter campaign earlier this year. He's here to talk with us about some of this week's hottest news, plus he's going to join us in a big discussion about the biggest trends of crowdfunding for 2012 and what's happening with that, plus his own experience of using Kickstarter. Just a little bit about Telecost Protocol, for which we will have a competition for you to enter later. Telecost Protocol is about a future where Earth is left barren by environmental collapse and humanity is on the brink of extinction. Alien technology, the only hope left for its underground population. But when aliens return to Earth, leaving destruction in their wake and a city in ruins, it falls to Steve Forrester, a soldier hated for a crime he did not commit, his partner Lily Goldstein, and scientist John Santilli to try and save the human race. An original and innovative graphic novel from debut creators Peter Cooper and Adam Byrne, Telecost Protocol takes the medium to a whole new level with mind-blowing artwork and a story packed full of action and intrigue.
Dramatic.
Very dramatic. But before we talk about kickstarting and crowdfunding, some of the news this week. I don't know if you've managed to ignore the fact that a proper trailer for World War Z has finally surfaced up from the depths of the internet and just kind of floated around for people to finally watch. As someone who tried out for some of the casting for extras when they were filming in Cornwall last year, it's nice to see that something's finally surfaced after all the setbacks that the film's had in production and post-production. But what does anyone sort of think of the trailer? He's managed to watch it.
Lots of running.
I mean, has anyone actually read World War Z? It's one of those.
Yeah, I have.
What's the novel like?
Well, the book is essentially treated like if you imagine one of those after the event documentary / historical books. It's a history book of the collapse of human society all around the world, and you know where the movie is kind of going down the line of, oh, I'm Brad Pitt, I've got to save the world from this massive disease / zombie infestation. The role of Brad Pitt is essentially an investigative journalist going around speaking to all these survivors and all these people who went through, you know, World War Z, and trying to piece together how the world reacted, how people responded, just telling all the different human angles of how the event unfolded, which is quite clearly what we're not getting.
No, that's definitely not what's happening with this trailer, which seems to be about some American guy trying to save his family from an apocalypse.
It's basically
Hollywood
Outbreak. It's Outbreak, but with zombies, and that's not good.
No.
Good old Hollywood strikes again, eh?
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but World War Z, it has to be Z, is pretty much all that, you know, the apocalypse has happened. This is the story of trying to find out, you know, what exactly is still left and looking back at it.
This seems to be the prequel to that, really, because at least the trailer, it's showing a lot of what happened when the infection hit.
Yeah.
And everything's just going to pot, basically. I'm not sure why they've gone with this, because they had an opportunity to make an interesting zombie film considering the source material, because I know a little bit about the source material. And yeah.
I'm going to throw it out there. Interesting doesn't sell.
No. But then again,
interesting, quirky just doesn't work. Yeah, you know, Hollywood look at it and go, okay, we need to turn this from interesting historical pseudo drama thing with Brad Pitt as investigative journalist into Brad Pitt, the guy that's coming from CDC who knows all about the viruses and stuff, and he's going to save the world and go on a hero's journey to save his family. Yeah, just that's Hollywood movies through and through.
It reminds me of I Am Legend a bit.
It's I Am Legend, but with a happy ending.
Watched an interesting zombie film, and that's Pontypool. And I'm not saying that they should have made Pontypool, because Pontypool's its own little thing, but I just think that they could have not Hollywoodized it so much.
I'm kind of hoping that it's going to keep to its namesake with the whole World War Z and actually kind of detail a global kind of catastrophe rather than, you know, kind of one story that's like in the middle of America, but it affects the entire world, but it's just in the middle of America kind of thing.
There were boats, really big boats. So maybe they're going to sell that. And it makes me wonder, though, whether or not they've actually kept the scenes that they filmed in Cornwall last year or not.
Hopefully so.
Oh, it would be kind of nice, because we had a couple of sort of acquaintances and stuff in it. And plus, we actually had a friend who did some of the makeup for when they were filming down here. So it'd be nice to see their handiwork on screen.
Definitely.
But
Another example of a film where as soon as I see what they're doing with it, I just think, I wish HBO or Showtime had got this, you know, for a series, you know, a 10-part series instead of a 2-hour film.
Wasn't it like Brad Pitt's their own production company that actually bought the rights to make the film in the first
place? Saved the rights, yeah. it's been in and out of production for a few years now, and Brad Pitt was like, no, I really want to make this. So he dove in. They've been rewrites after rewrites after rewrites trying to get it greenlit. And at the last moment, they finally got the money required to make this stupendous script and finally got the go-ahead to do it. I mean, the one thing that strikes me looking at the trailer and looking at the quality of the footage that's there is it is actually really good quality.
Mm.
It's just not World War Z/Z.
No.
It's not what people want. It's not what people are going, oh man, I'd love to see a movie of that. They weren't saying it about what you're seeing in the trailer, they're seeing it based on the book. And I'm all for seeing people take a whole new angle on it, but that's not taking any angle on it. It's just turning it into something completely different.
It's a film. That's what it is.
It's a big action adaptation. Yeah.
There again, to be fair, I mean, the trailer has just kind of launched and you can never tell quite, you know, with the trailer how the film's going to go.
I'm going to throw it out here though, big pile of running zombies. It's quite clearly not anything near what people are going for. It's just Brad Pitt running away from massive hordes of stupendously quick running zombies. It's nothing like the original thing.
It's quite interesting though.
Actually, this point, what kind of zombies were in the book for World War Z?
Shambling zombies. They walk across the bottom of the sea. They're proper undead, and you know, there's entire story points in World War Z/Z surrounding the fact that Britain is effectively isolated from the whole thing, and they survive perfectly fine. The British survive perfectly fine. They basically put militias on the beaches, and whenever a zombie shambles up, they just shoot it.
That would be the way to go in that situation.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah. It's perfect.
What about Australia, though? Were they too big to save themselves?
I imagine Australia is too big with too much coastline and not enough people.
Yeah.
Hawaii.
Hawaii. Ooh. Yeah, it's too high.
I have no idea. I assume they just got incinerated
the
massive.
I think it's making me want to read the novel more and then watch the film and potentially be sorely disappointed.
You know what would be nice with this? If all that footage was only representative of the first 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah.
That would be nice.
If that prefaced it and the rest of it was actually as you've described the book,
that'd be pretty
then
mean.
Hooray! And I'm all for misleading trailers so long as it gets bums on seats.
It's like there's a great set piece in the book, the Battle of Yonkers, where you'll see art pieces based on this particular set piece throughout the internet and stuff, and it's this huge battle between ground forces and the zombies. It's the stuff that action films were made for, but again, it's nothing like what we see. And the thing is, all the hints of what we're seeing in the trailer
are
basically saying we just can't get it. The fact they've gone for the crazy horde of running zombies that, in spite of how few there are, they're still able to make a massive pile just by running into walls.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's quite clear that is going to be one of the CGI money shots of the entire film. That's why they put it in the trailer. You always see the best bits of films in the trailers.
Yeah, all hail CGI.
Yeah.
CGI, which I love, but you can mostly see it from a mile off. And yeah, with you saying about, you know, the big piles of zombies,
yeah,
you know, forming like that, it looks like a CGI demo.
It's going for that whole Starship Troopers effect.
Yeah,
you know, Whiskey Outpost.
Yeah.
And the thing is, they haven't done better than Whiskey Outpost in, you know, well, how many years would that be?
The Starship Troopers was what, early? No, was it?
It's 97. Yes, 97 it was released.
Yes.
Which is insane, thinking about it, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, you look at some of the films from the late 90s, and they had this wonderful, you know, when you had Phil Tippett at the height of his career doing all kinds of amazing work. You had the guys from Stan Winston Studios doing brilliant work as well. And stuff like Jurassic Park, even to some extent Star Wars Episode One, even some of the stuff in that holds up perfectly fine.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of it doesn't, I freely admit, but... Yeah, it's a lot
CGI
of
CGI sort of... was, but that's the problem with Star Wars: Phantom Menace, isn't it? You relied too much on the CGI rather than actually telling the proper story.
It's just more cost effective, is the problem. Mm-hmm. You can do a lot more with CGI for a lot less than you can with spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on, you know, prosthetics and, you know, monster suits and stuff like that.
Of all the problems with Phantom Menace, CGI was not one of mine.
No. CGI was pretty good.
Yeah, it's like
fifth
CGI, that's
as
fine.
Well. How good was the fifth element?
Yes.
I think I'm gonna have to steer the conversation way here because we were heavy into the Star Wars last week. So on to our next piece of news. It is the end of Hellblazer as we know it, as the claws of the new 52 sink into over 20 year history of comic. Yes, and
I feel fine.
Yeah, it's not like I've read every single issue of John Constantine Hellblazer. It's not like I've read every issue. I've read quite a few, and I really like the character and stuff. And before, with the whole New 52 initiative, I hadn't been affected as a fan, and so I wasn't quite seeing what the issues were because suddenly series were readable to me and that. But now they've come for Hellblazer. And now I'm just like, I would have almost been fine until I took some time to read some Dark Justice League, or Justice League Dark. I read the first couple of issues of that, and I was like, oh, frail. That's what Constantine's going to become. Because they're ending Hellblazer in issue 300, and then straight after... Constantine issue 1 comes out, and if it's anything like the Constantine in Justice League Dark, then I am not a happy bunny, because
it does actually state that it's going to be the Constantine from Justice League Dark, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is. Everything's saying it is. And
I haven't actually been able to get Justice League Dark. So what's he like in that then? Is he a complete twit?
Well, it's like he's none of the punk element that's in his younger days in the original comics is there, and he's meant to be of that age. It's like, oh, he's a bit swarmy, a bit kind of mouthy, but he's nothing like what he is. He hasn't gone through, it doesn't seem like he's gone through anything near the personal levels of tragedy that he has in the original comics.
That was part of the point. It's like, let's reboot Superman, but have him, you know, have Krypton not explode and his parents still be alive and not be on Earth.
Well, and visit every Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's just, I mean, I've been, because they've been re-releasing like the sort of collected volumes of the earlier Constantine lately. So I've got up to volume 3 so far. But I've also been reading some of the newer stuff. I started around about this one-shot type thing, which was City of Demons, which was written by Cy Spencer. And then I've been reading
the early stuff, especially, is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, but I've also been reading some of the current stuff, like him getting married to this young alchemist and stuff. And there was some pretty messed up stuff going on, which is going to be basically completely wiped out from this Constantine, who's going to be so sanitized that he might as well not even smoke.
Oh, God. Really?
Yeah, he's just, it's like it'd be the most rebellious thing he's doing is smoking. There's hardly any swearing. There's hardly any disrespect for authority. I mean, come on.
Are you basically asking for some kind of hipster Constantine?
I'm asking for Constantine to be Constantine, which is a guy who isn't normal. And I mean, the way they portrayed his like for the Black Arts in the original sort of starting of this series, he was a bit haphazard in it, but he quickly grew respectful of what black magic.
He learned
magic.
Quite quickly.
He learned really quickly. Actually, you really shouldn't mess with this stuff.
Yeah, with reference to the Manchester incident, I remember.
Is it Manchester or Newcastle?
Manchester. I was going to say Manchester. It was going to be either Manchester or Newcastle. I couldn't quite remember. Yeah, but yeah, it was mentioned a few times as this was a very bad thing.
And he ended up in an asylum for a while as well, which he keeps having flashbacks and stuff to in the early stuff. And
I get the feeling there's a certain hint of Martin Niemöller here. It's like, first they came for Superman and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Superman fan. Then they came for Batman and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Batman fan. Then they came for Wonder Woman and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Wonder Woman fan. And then they came for Constantine and there was no one left to speak for me.
I'll just say I've been a comic fan for years. I've been slightly lax on it over the last five or so. But the whole thing was, if ever they did a whenever they've done a reboot, and I must have seen about three or four of these bloody things, it's never affected any titles I'm interested in, because the closest I've got to mainstream are things like Doom Patrol and Shade, the Changing Man. That's about the closest I've ever got. But the very fact, rebooting Constantine, why would you?
I think one of the things that offended me the most about reading Justice League Dark was the fact that he was together with other people, he wasn't isolated. That's one of the things in the regular comics, the original comics, is he's actually quite isolated. He doesn't have any real friends, because whenever he makes friends, funnily enough, they don't tend to stick around for long, because they usually end up rather dead. Yeah. And he's friends with, like, friggin' Satana. In fact, actually, it ends up going out with her a bit and stuff. I mean, friggin' Satana. And it's like, come the heck on. Constantine is usually such bad news that something terrible in regular Constantine would have happened by now. But no, everything's fine. Except for maybe the guy that brought them together, who Satana was going out with, kind of went a bit AWOL and blarg. It's just kind of like,
I don't know. I can see the reasoning why they would do this. Admittedly, the outrage is perfectly fair. The same way people were outraged about the fact they were rebooting all of those other titles. I mean, I'm going to freely admit I've never read Hellblazer. If I was to try and engage with it, I'd be diving onto various internet forums going, I want to read Hellblazer. Which books should I read? And I'll then end up with like 50 different opinions as to where the entry point is for the story.
I mean, you could say the entry point is Swamp Thing, but I basically say, no, just go with collective volumes, which is where they go from basically Constantine issue one upwards.
I would too, yeah.
Yeah.
It's the same thing though with Judge Dredd. The other week I was asking, so I didn't see Dredd and I liked it. I liked it a lot. Yeah. And I was like, it's been years since I read Judge Dredd. I used to get 2000 AD on a fairly regular basis. And, it's been years since I read it. So where shall I, if I want to dive into classic Dredd, where do I start? And then I actually put up a post and I had 15 different players going, all right, you should read, these case files and this book. And I'm like, come on, guys. Surely there should be a collected point where you go, actually, this is the best place to start. And not from the very beginning, because the very beginning can always be a bit dicey. So, you got 300 issues of Hellblazer that someone's got to sit through to kind of bring them up to speed.
I'm not.
It's intimidating.
I'm not worried about the fact that they're restarting the series. It's the fact that they're pretty much completely changing the character with the restart. That is what's I find particularly galling.
The thing is, you've got a lot of time to fix it.
Yep. Sorry there, but
sorry.
Twitter log, not Twitter log. Jesus.
You were gonna say retros.
Skype log. Yes. If you're going to, wouldn't this character be better if he wasn't like this and was like that instead. Do another character.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if everyone says, oh, that's Constantine Light. Fair enough, fine, whatever, but at least you're not doing it to the actual character.
Yeah.
I don't understand why you would do that.
I also get the suspicion that they certainly won't mess around with... I mean, he's never been a straight and narrow character.
No.
Has a sexuality that cannot be clearly defined and likes mind-altering substances and cigarettes and lots of booze and likes making... I mean, okay, in the earlier stuff, he made more political commentary, but it always sneaks in a bit in the comics when he's flicking it. And another thing, though, about the Justice League Dark is that he's pretty much always in America.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's all right, though, because, you know, they're messing with the catch to such a point where that he's going to get really drunk, have a sex change, and vote for Obama again. So it's all fine.
Well, do you know, I was reading it, and he basically he went over to the States on a holiday visa, and then several years later, he's still in the States. I'm like, either I have to read more to find out when the immigration authorities catch up to him, or that's an entire plot hole they've just kind of left. The fact that Constantine's basically permanently in the US and actually should have been deported ages ago.
What you don't know is the fact that his ID didn't actually check out in the first place. So he's a non-person. He doesn't exist. He just runs around going from state to state, living life loosely, living on the edge. I'd love that. That'd be a great existence, don't you think?
Yeah.
Just rides around on a motorbike.
But he does occasionally need medical attention, so this could become problematic.
Yeah.
I probably haven't said enough about this, but it's okay because I'm writing a piece for Games Fiends about how much I'm not happy about this. So it'll be fine. I'll eventually have completely vented my spleen.
Just as a matter of interest.
Mm-hmm.
If you, Emily, were actually in charge of rebooting Hellblazer, how would you do it?
How would I do it? I would stick a lot to the original, but update a lot of the cultural references. I would have had him starting it, because he sort of starts out in the 70s a bit, and like the comics are set more in the early 80s. So I would have kind of shifted that for 10, 15 years. Kind of made it more 90s, maybe have him at the tail end of like the last Tory government.
Make him a Green Day fan.
Yeah, make him a Green Day fan. Oh, I don't know. Nirvana. Nirvana. And I mean, maybe he would have been into some new metal or something. You
really dug the Offspring.
Yeah, he awesome. Maybe
I'm not saying a thing.
But no,
we can hear it from here.
I think it's the fact that I still would have kept in a lot of the fact that he has a lot of personal torture and self-afflicted pain.
He's amoral and is sometimes a bit of an asshole.
Yeah. I would have kept
those are the two most important things about him.
Not to sort of cycle around again, but you're still making him sound like House.
He was House before House existed. He usually
has well before House.
I like House, that newcomer. I like to believe that House is some kind of social constant. There is always a House. There's always been a House. There will always be a House. It's not that House is a character. He's a state of mind.
Yeah.
But does Constantine have a very strange, unplaceable, really irksome accent when he's in America?
No, but he does have a doctor friend who's got cancer.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true. I'm just trying to make stuff
He's
up.
He's had doctor friends jokes. In the past. Whether or not they've had cancer is another matter.
They may have never known they had cancer.
Yeah.
Probably demonic enough. Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on to our last bit of news. Apparently, the PS Vita is maybe tanking a bit in Japan. Like, in the last couple of weeks, there was 1 week where its sales were around maybe, was it 3,000 or 4,000 odd units. Meanwhile, the PSP was selling in that same week over 10,000 units.
You're doing it wrong.
I'm not sure what it's like for Europe and America. It's the fact that it's obviously a home brand for Japan and it's doing so badly that I find particularly worrying. I mean, does anyone have any idea about what the heck's going on?
Yeah, it's quite simple. You haven't got enough games for it.
it's too pricey, the games are too pricey, there aren't enough of them.
Everyone's already got one.
That was going to get one. Or is it their favorite you're referring to?
Yeah, oh, they've already got one. They don't need, you know, they don't need more of them. There are plenty of them around. They need to share more. In fact, that's probably it. They're probably sharing them.
That must be it.
Yeah. They've realized that there's a downturn in the economy. They need to sort of, you know, pull up their bootstraps, deal with this the best way possible, share their Vitas.
Is Final Fantasy X available on at least the Japanese PSN store yet, or has that not been released?
I don't think so.
No, you see, there's their problem. They aren't talking to third-party publishers enough, going, guys.
It's all right.
Guys!
They've got a brilliant tactical plan. In the next couple of weeks, you'll see it fly off the stores, especially in Europe and America, when Call of Duty is released on it. Don't panic about that.
Call of Duty, which I've heard has about an hour worth of single player.
Oh, I don't know. I know the multiplayer was only going to be like four people at a time.
So just imagine.
Oh,
you're on your PS Vita 3G version playing multiplayer Call of Duty.
Oh yeah,
on the train. Don't forget, you've got to play it on the train.
On the train.
That would be a superb experience.
Definitely.
I'd be getting too, ticked off at the fact that I'm being completely owned by little Japanese kids on the train. I'd be freaking out at that stage, going, "What am I doing wrong?"
For me, it is simply the games. I've got a Vita, as you all know, and I am going to defend it to my death because I've actually bought it. So,
It is a lovely machine.
I went and bought Liberation for it the other week, and I'm loving it. Assassin's Creed Liberation. Yeah. Excellent title for it. Really shows off what the Vita can do, but there's just not enough games.
I mean, to be honest, though, because obviously there's the obvious comparison of the 3DS versus it, and the same's pretty much been said of the 3DS, that it's not got enough, decent, unique games.
It's selling a bit better. I don't know, I think it's because out of the DS versus the PSP in the previous generation, the DS brand managed to get ingrained in people's minds a bit more than the PSP did,
It did lose out massively to the DS, didn't it?
Yeah.
Nintendo's always had this stranglehold on handheld gaming. They've always had the domination on the handheld gaming market.
It's quite interesting because they've always held that position from a technologically inferior perspective. Because, back to the Game Boy versus Game Gear, Gear was so much more advanced.
And Atari Lynx, which had nice zoomy rotaty sprites and things like that going on.
Batman Returns on the Atari Lynx was amazing.
Yeah.
Driving sections in the Batmobile.
I mean, the Lynx itself could be used as a blunt murder weapon, but that's not the point.
you could attach it onto the end of, bits of wood and use them as some kind of pickaxe. Mm.
You could fit wheels to the Lynx and use it as a car.
I don't have a PS Vita.
Well, is the reason Nintendo have always had this hold on, well, one of the reasons anyway, is because of the battery life, I think. If you compare the Game Boy to the Game Gear, people preferred the Game Boy because it was lighter, because it didn't take 700 million batteries at once and wasted an hour's of batteries. I had a friend who came around once with a Game Gear, and there was about 8 batteries in there, and it lasted us about an hour and a half before it went totally dead.
Why you had your little car charger thing, wasn't it?
Yeah. Both the Game Gear and the Lynx ran on 6 AA batteries, and with both of them, if you were lucky, you got around about 2 hours.
Before they went.
Yeah, before they were completely drained. Mm. The Game Boy could go 18, 20 hours.
Any parent with any sense got the AC adapter as the first peripheral on that thing.
Fix their electricity tariff.
Well, I mean, even nowadays, because the PSP was originally kind of slated because of its low battery life. The fact that you could buy UMDs for it, like videos. And you wouldn't actually be able to get through an entire one without kind of charging it up. Well, certainly not something like Lord of the Rings.
I like how we come full circle on this. We've been working so hard to become more energy efficient, build devices that last for not hours, but days.
Yep.
Mm. You know, we've gone through the whole mobile cycle where we've been working hard to have phones that, you know, have up to 4 days, you know, 4, 5, 6, even a week's worth of charge. And then they brought out the iPhone.
24 hours.
Yeah, and then the Samsung Galaxy and all this. And it's like, nah, nah, 6 hours. 6 hours max. Have fun, guys.
Yeah, getting back to the, you know, the Vita. And I'm amazed I'm the one actually saying that. usually I'm the one that just buggers off somewhere and starts talking about something else entirely. But the problem, one of the problems with the Vita is the Sony support itself. They haven't got enough in the, you know, the release schedule for it.
Yeah.
Just the fact that it's only recently they've added PS1 compatibility to it, which blows my mind. It's like, come on, the PSP has got PS1 compatibility, and that's one of the best things about the, you know, the original PSP. Yeah. So it's like, come on, Sony, if you can get a software emulator for the PS2 running on the PS3, which they have with some of the games they've released on PSN, there you go, killer app. Get PS2 games. Yeah. Purchasable over PSN, get them playable on the PS Vita as well. Yep. Release a few of the, like as you said, you know, Final Fantasy X.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. It's like, come on. You need more software. Even if it's not entirely new PS Vita software, you've got all that back catalogue. Get them playable.
And it's one of the reasons why the PlayStation and PlayStation 2 is so successful, because of their, you know, wide catalogue of games.
Yeah.
Yes.
So why not utilize
But then
that?
Again, I mean, think about it from Sony's angle, what if the issue is more actual the original publishers of the games?
Mm.
You know, not being keen.
Yeah, it's a bit like why like catch upon demand services are so sketchy. Is basically because when the original programs and whatnot were created, they didn't actually, you know, stick that into the contracts of what they can do.
Yeah, so they've got to renegotiate things.
Exactly. So.
But the reason I mentioned the whole thing with trying to get PS2 games playable on it, on, you know, all the things like that, is they've already got the backwards compatibility with PSP on the Vita. And they're doing this big deal with PlayStation Plus, where they're getting people to, like me, to pay, you know, a yearly subscription and get things, you know, shoved at you, either included in the price or at a discount. That encourages you to stick with the brand, with the machines. They're going to be rolling Vita into that. So it's just, you've already got the situation where they must have been going to various companies and saying, you know, you're releasing Grand Theft Auto 5. So can we get Grand Theft Auto Vice City and 3 playable or, you know, on the PS3 and, you know, saleable over, you know, the PlayStation Network? So if they're doing it for the PS3, why can't they say, oh, and the Vita as well?
Mm.
Makes sense.
I just want to point out, GTA by City on the Vita would be brilliant.
Yes.
But you can get the PSP versions for them already on the Vita. You can get the Vice City Stories and Liberty City Stories.
Yeah. Although download only.
Download only. But I actually really enjoyed them on the PSP.
I still find it shocking that PS2 sells. I mean, I know they've got the huge games library. I mean, they've got thousands of games, quite literally now, for PS2 after such a long development cycle and so on.
Yeah.
But you still see, you know, units going of PS2s week in, week out.
Well, EA have still been selling their yearly sports titles on it.
Yeah.
It's absolutely, you know, when you sort of take a step back and think about it. I mean, we're talking about how. Yeah, it's you know, we're only seeing a few thousand units of Vitas going out a week, if that. It's like you're still seeing at least 1,000 units of PS2s going out. And how long has that been around for? Like a decade?
It's like
the AK-47 of games console. I mean, you can leave it underground for 10 years, covered in mud, throw mud into all the slots and in all the heat exchanges and everything. It's all right, you pull it out, plug it in, still works.
You say that, but
I've never had a PS2 fail on me. Now PS3, on the other hand,
yeah, I've had a PS1 fail on me, two PS3s, one PS2, not a PSP though. and I've had three. So
I've had the UMD drive go on my PSP.
Yeah, and
you had three PSPs. Yeah. Not one of them failed, yet you've had three of them now.
At different
times. Used as bookends.
Well, it was. I had the original one, and then I sold that because I just wasn't getting any playtime out of it. And then I picked one up again when you could do interesting things with the software on it. And then I've since bought another one.
You see,
I will say I do not support piracy. The only games I play on it are ones I do actually own on UMD. So,
Our PSP that's got, because we've got two now. We've got one that does have a working UMD drive, and the original one that doesn't. And the one that doesn't has basically become a dedicated Final Fantasy device because we just downloaded all the sort of Final Fantasy 1 games, well, PS1 versions of the games that were available, whatever, on the PSN store. Yeah.
And they work very well on it.
Yeah. So, I think that's enough of the news for now. Just want to say, we said earlier that we've got a competition, but I just wanted to first up announce the winner of our Resident Evil Blu-ray box set competition. And the winner is... Can I get some form of drum roll? Is anyone available for drum roll? And the winner is Jack Campbell. Congratulations.
Hey.
We will contact you to figure out how to get the chunky bit of box set your way. But this week you've also got another competition, and we're hoping to give away 5 digital copies of Telecost Protocol Issue 1. If you want to be in with a chance of winning, we're going to be posting a tweet for this competition. And basically, all you have to do is follow both the at Telecost Protocol Twitter and the at Nerds Podcast Twitter and retweet the special tweet that we're going to be putting out, which is basically, want to win issue, want a Telecost Protocol, follow Telecost Protocol and Nerds Podcast and retweet this message to be in with a chance. Ends 26th of November, 12 p.m. GMT. Yeah, that pretty much sums it up. So basically... look around for that tweet. We'll obviously be posting it on a regular basis so that you can see it and retweet it and, you know, enter. And obviously remember to follow us. So the deadline is the 26th of November at 12 p.m. GMT. This competition is open to anyone regardless of where they are in the world, unlike the previous competition.
And the universe.
Yeah, if you've got a connection to Earth Internet, we can get... this comic to you, so enter.
But only within a few in about.
Well, that's a good point. It depends how fast we can transmit the information.
I was going to say only within about a light week.
A light week distance. Okay, we'll go over. Okay,
it doesn't matter. It still takes you only 5 minutes to send it. It's just going to take him a week to make sure they actually get it. Issue is line of sight. That's what we need to keep up.
Okay, now that we've got that out of the way, why have we got Peter here this week? Well, we wanted to talk about Kickstarter, or basically crowdfunding in general, because it seems that 2012 has kind of become the year of crowdfunding on services like Kickstarter, Indiegogo, and many others. And Peter's very well acquainted with this, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
Between yourselves,
I'd say so. I mean,
between yourselves and Vanquish, you know.
Yeah, between us and Vanquish, we managed to get through our 1 month of Kickstarter hell and came out the other end with $50,000 worth of backer support. So did pretty well. To date, we are the highest funded debut comics artists and writers on Kickstarter. We've raised the most money out of any debut comics creators, so definitely something you're proud of.
Okay, so we've got some questions we'd like to ask you before we kind of get onto a general discussion. Now, my one is, how come Vanquish and yourself decided to go with Kickstarter rather than Indiegogo?
Well, there's a lot of benefits to be had from Kickstarter, and we actually found out a lot more as a result of doing the Kickstarter, because the way that both Indiegogo and Kickstarter work to some degree is basically they've got a built-in community, but Kickstarter is much, much larger. So whenever you have a big big appeal on Indiegogo or anything like that, yeah, and they want to flag it up, they'll send emails out to all of Indiegogo's subscribers saying, hey guys, we've got this big thing, it's doing really well, you should support it too. And that, in fairness, it works really well. I mean, for a comparative example, there's Romantically Apocalyptic. Are you familiar with that webcomic?
Vaguely.
They're cool. It's the story of Captain and his minions as they go through the abandoned wasteland of a post-apocalyptic world. Good fun, very surreal, fantastic artwork. And they ran an Indiegogo roughly at the same time as we were running our Kickstarter. They ran theirs for a month and a half. It was about 45 days, I think. And they came out with a very similar figure to ours. Just going to quickly pull up the Indiegogo here and take a look. And it was interesting seeing, you know, in spite of the fact they've already got an audience. They have tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people checking in for every single issue or every single release they put out on their website. Yeah, I was speaking with the guys from there, and they said they have six-figure numbers of people who are subscribed to their RSS feeds. Now, they managed, through Indiegogo, in spite of the fact they've got this built-in community and everything else already existing, and they've got the Indiegogo community as well, they raised $51,873. Fantastic result. Mm. They were looking for $10,000 originally, so they blew it away. And they did absolutely fantastically. Now, Telecost Protocol, they're, you know, completely new. No one's heard of us before. We'd released a small teaser book of our prelude, which was available from Thought Bubble last year in Leeds, and practically unheard of at this stage. We went on to Kickstarter, and we managed to raise $50,119. So we made up nearly the same amount of funds, in spite of being complete no-namers who had never released a single thing in our lives.
Brilliant.
And it was interesting looking at the stats as time went on, because, you know, as with all these things, you know, you only get what you put in. And, you know, early on, a lot of the support was coming from Twitter, from Facebook and stuff like that. And, you know, there was a time when it was 75% Facebook and then 25% from Kickstarter, still a substantial amount. By the end of it, it was 65% Kickstarter and 35% outside sources. So it was entirely coming from the actual pre-existing community on Kickstarter and not from outside sources.
That's pretty impressive.
Cool.
Yes, and where, by contrast, with Indiegogo and stuff like that, very often you are reliant on these outside sources pouring money in. It's about you getting onto Twitter, getting onto all these things, and pouring all of your effort into trying to get the word out about your project and trying to get that working. So when we initially set up with Kickstarter, it was a case of, okay, this is a way of getting our name out there. This is a way of getting noticed. We want to raise $9,500. It's a meager amount, not too much. We should be able to achieve that. Not realizing that there was such a large community involved with Kickstarter that would take it well beyond its goal. So That was kind of unforeseen. We were focusing on it mainly as a means of trying to get the word about the book out there and trying to help cover our production costs for the first couple of issues. We knew that Kickstarter was a way of getting noticed, not necessarily from production, from a publishing standpoint, because we already had a publisher. That wasn't really our concern.
Yeah.
It was more about just trying to get a certain element of notoriety with fans, because we're an unknown property trying to build a whole new universe. It's something that we hadn't done before, and something that people didn't know about. What better way is there than to go into a place where you're publicly saying, this is us, this is what we're about, show off the artwork, what do you think, put your money where your mouth is. Yeah. It was an interesting way of basically trying to get a bit of coverage while at the same time also trying to build up our own community and everything else while, also having to cover costs. But as I say, we never anticipated the result that we got. We never thought, we're going to blow this up. We're going to go well beyond our original plans. Mm. $9,500 through to over 50,000.
Mm.
Never expected. And you know, so Kickstarter initially, that was more of a decision because of the fact that it had, you know, we knew that it was a very effective method. I found it a little bit easier to use compared to Indiegogo as well. Actually setting up your Kickstarter and going through all that, I found it a lot more straightforward on Kickstarter rather than Indiegogo. The only problem with Kickstarter was the fact that you had to be US based.
I was just going to raise that. I was just thinking,
yeah, that was a limitation which was only there because of the fact that it's all tied in with Amazon, the Amazon payment scheme. You needed to be US registered and US based to be able to set up an account so you could receive the money back from them when you actually completed the Kickstarter. That's the only reason why it was US based.
But then they've changed that now, finally.
They have. And we're now seeing some great creator work coming in from the UK. They've opened the floodgates now. there's no turning back, and I can't wait to see what UK creators are going to do with it, because you know, we were lucky in that we had people in the States who were able to assist with us and make sure that we could deliver and that we could actually make our Kickstarter happen. Otherwise, we would have been consigned with just using Indiegogo. And I think that if that had been the case, the outreach for our project would have been much, much smaller. So, yeah, very thankful for having that support and being able to key in with the Kickstarter community, because you know, they made the appeal happen. They made it work.
Okay, I think Paul B's got a question.
Yeah. What's the best way to get your project in front of people so that they'll actually support it? And as a second part to this question, did having Vanquish behind you really help?
Well, what made our project really stand out in terms of, you know, how it was being seen by the Kickstarter community and everything was having a very effective, very clear, to some extent concise, but basically just having the right package, being able to sell your project in the right way, having the right video, the right materials, and selling it the way it needs to be sold. Because if you do it the right way and you have a project and a product that sells itself, essentially, the staff pick up on that on Kickstarter. They really do. And what you'll find is that very quickly those projects that people really latch onto and really like and build up a reputation very quickly, they'll become staff picks. And that is probably the best way of getting your project noticed. I mean, you can go about it a lot of other ways. I mean, every once in a while we'd get an endorsement from someone. I was really, really proud when I saw a tweet flash onto my Twitter from Michael A. Stackpole, sci-fi writer.
Oh yeah.
He's done lots of stuff with he's done stuff for Star Wars extended universe stuff. He's also done stuff for the MechWarrior BattleTech universe. He's done probably some of the best novels for that series. So to have him go on Twitter and go, "Hey, I've just seen this awesome new project, fund it," and to have him back us as well. Not only is that very rewarding from, you know, my own standpoint, I was really chuffed when I saw that come through. But it's like, oh my god, one of my fighting heroes likes my stuff. I geeked out something rotten, and I still am. But you know, they'll tweet it to their followers, and it'll spread. I mean, I know we got quite a few from there. Naturally, if you can get outreach from getting your Kickstarter mentioned on blogs and on all these news sites and everything, regardless of whether it's a comic, whether it's a tech, an item of tech or some kind of electronic device or some new fangled gadget. Or even if it's, you know, like an arts project and you get lots of dance troupes and stuff like that doing work on there and, you know, film projects and stuff. It doesn't matter what it is. If you can get outreach on important, relevant blogs and onto news sites, that will naturally help. But certainly in our experience, becoming a staff pick and being on the front page of Kickstarter every other day, that really, really helped. Because
that would.
Well, yeah, it would naturally. You've got hundreds of thousands of people going onto the website, and the first thing that's flashing up when they go on there and they see a staff pick, oh, Telecost Protocol, let's check it out. It's quite clear the staff like it. It looks quality. You know, to be on the front page, it's got to look good.
Hmm.
So if you put the effort into making sure your Kickstarter looks the best it possibly can be, it increases your chances of getting onto the front page, and it increases the chances of, you know, getting that outreach. I mean, just by being on the front page, that resulted in us getting onto a couple of news sites, and that then helped spiral it. I mean, I know we showed up on Bleeding Cool, and that got us like 40 backers within an hour of the news piece being posted.
Wow.
Yeah, you can see the correlation between it showing up on a major news site and it, you know, you're suddenly you've got another $1,000 or whatever of support. You know, it doesn't take much to fathom out the logic. The more people talk about your stuff, the more likely you're going to get money.
With something like that, even if you're not getting people giving you feedback through comments or whatever, you can see where it's having an effect and how much of an effect it's having on your fundraising.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that you've got very extensive data from Indiegogo. From what I understand, far more extensive than you get from Kickstarter. But even reading Kickstarter, you know, in the same way you look at your web analytics for your website or anything else, you can see where people are being linked to and from. You can see if they're finding it through Google, Facebook, Twitter, through specific news sites. And naturally, if people then go ahead and fund your book or fund whatever, you can see just how much is coming as a result of links from these various sources. And you can use that information to your advantage and basically help guide your appeal in the right direction.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, you mentioned Vanquish and whether or not it was good to have Vanquish alongside us. I'd say it definitely was. The more people you can have on side with you helping out with the Kickstarter, because it's a lot of hard work from start to finish. Before you even start the Kickstarter, you got to plan it all out. You got to make sure your rewards are up to scratch. The better placed you are for being able to deal with the strain that is going to kick in when you set that up, the more likely you are that you're going to be able to, you know, handle what's going to follow, because it's tough.
Mm.
You know, it's if you go in for a Kickstarter, you're going to have a very long month. I mean, I was working the Kickstarter every waking hour for 30 days. And when I was asleep, the guys in America were. And, you know, it's tiring. It's long hours, lots of people to talk to. You know, you get the comments through, you want to reply to those. People ask, oh, I want to give you X amount, kind of combine two pledges together to get like double the stuff, but for not quite so much money. Yeah, I can do that. You got to be keep constantly giving the feedback back to fans who are looking to engage with you. And the more people you have with you, the more likely you are that you're able to actually do that and not lose your mind, go a bit crazy and go postal. That's really useful.
Cookie, do you want to ask your question?
Yeah, so if you were to do the whole Kickstarter thing again, would there be anything you would do differently?
The first thing I would do, with regards, have you looked at the Kickstarter appeal for us? Because the video is awful. I've heard really good positive feedback about it. You know, going, yeah, this actually sells the project really well. But the most annoying thing about the video is the opening of the video has me going, "Hi." if you play the video, I swear to God, you will hear that and just go, "Oh no."
I don't think it's the worst one on there.
It's not the worst one. I was actually having a conversation about this the other day, because I mean, I know I've mentioned this in our prior conversation. There's the Kickstarter currently running for Hellblazer, the fan film based on the aforementioned comic that we just had our ramble on earlier on, and It's 5.5 minutes long. There are so many rules you have to follow about trying to create a good Kickstarter, because a good Kickstarter engages people quickly. You don't have to go through too much to get a feel for what it is you're trying to do, and it sells you on the concept within a few moments of watching, whether it be the video, whether it be the images that you use to sell the idea. It's basically got to sell people incredibly quickly, and once people are sold, that's it, you're done. You know, you don't need to say anything else. You know, the rest of the writing that you put on there is more than likely going to be ignored. They're either going to pledge or they're not. It's kind of like how when people go on a website, you have 5 seconds to make an impression. If you don't make the impression, they'll just click off. It's the same deal with the Kickstarter. And with the Hellblazer thing, their video is 5.5 minutes long. The first minute and a half of the video is just panels of comic art with dramatic music, which is completely pointless. So, I mean, you know, all things considered, my video is actually pretty good.
But you would like to do it differently.
I'd revise the voiceover for sure. other things I'd do, one of the big mistakes we made was, and this is down to the fact that we really undersold ourselves. We really underestimated what the fan reaction was going to be like. We put $9,500 thinking that was a really hard target to achieve, and we achieved it in a day and a half. When I think back on that, I just go, man, that was a big cock up. Because one of the big things that everyone bought into was the limited edition hardcover of the first volume of the book. So the first volume is the first 3 issues combined together. We were kind of working on the basis it was going to be about 180 pages, 150 pages of comic, 30 pages of bonus material. And we thought, okay, we'll put it at $80. That's a lot of money. You know, people aren't going to go out of their way to buy that.
Mm-hmm.
And they did. Boy, did they. They sold out within 2 days. And one of the problems was that everyone was coming around going, oh man, I really want one of the hardbacks. Have you got any more of the hardbacks left? Yes, but you've got to buy the $350 thing. Well, I don't want them that much, but I do want a hardback. And yeah, naturally, I aim to please. And I was trying to think, okay, how? Oh no, we've written ourselves into a corner here. How do we get hardbacks to people? So halfway through the appeal, we're busy scrambling around trying to work out what on earth we can do to facilitate this. Because it's like, we're screwed. What are we going to do? We can't just change it around. Because the idea was it was going to be a limited number of books. It was only going to be 100.
Yeah.
And people are asking, oh, well, if I'm getting volume 1, can't I get volume 2 and 3? We hadn't even thought of that. When we started off, we were going, we'll focus on volume 1. That's what this is about. We never thought people would be so up for it, so into what we were doing, that they'd want every single issue in print. They'd want every single volume of the book, and they want to pre-order it right now when it's not even going to be out for 3 years. Yeah, they want volume. They want to buy volume 3 right now, and you know, we haven't even started the artwork. It's like a twinkle in our mind's eye. we haven't even done it. So we're going, what are we going to do? And I ended up having this massive consultation with all the people who had bought the hardback, going, all right, look, this is our proposed plan. We keep the 100 limited ones. We make them a little bit more special with a different cover and all this. And then we have a second edition of the hardcover, and we make that available right now. And thankfully, people were okay with that.
But it's not necessarily going to be the case for other people trying to do similar things. I suppose it depends what crowd you're playing to.
it does depend. Yeah. I mean, if you're going to have limited, because another thing was we actually had special bundle deals where you could be in the comic. We priced it at $500, and they sold out within a week. We only had 5 of those. We're going, did we just put really low prices on this stuff? Is this the problem? Is this what we've done? Have we basically completely undersold our product? I don't think we did. If we did, then we gained great success as a result of doing that. But what I would say is, if you're going to do anything, just make sure that when you think about your project, when you think in context, you know, what if this does go big? You know, keep that in mind. You know, naturally you want to sort of err on the side of caution on the possibility that it doesn't go big. But if it does, are you going to have enough options for people? Are you going to, you know, you don't want to have too many levels that people can pledge at, because that just confuses things. And we ended up with like 15 different levels you could pledge at by the end of it, and that got very confusing as well. So try and keep it relatively straightforward. Try and keep it not so confusing. And just make sure you don't kind of, like I say, write yourself into a corner where you've only got a certain number of items. They've all sold out in the first wave. And because of the way that you've structured what it is you're offering, you can't offer anymore because it just devalues whatever it is you've already got in place. You know, one of the most important things you will ever do when you work out your Kickstarter is work out what offers you can make for people. You know, what you can offer in the way of pledge rewards.
Yeah.
And, you know, and if you reach the point where you've already succeeded, you then got to come up with a whole new set of rewards and a whole new set of pledge, stretch goals and other things people can pledge for. Because once you hit your target, if you've got nothing else to offer, there's no reason for people to support you. I mean, it's interesting seeing how people respond to role playing games and how people structure the Kickstarters on there. Because, I mean, this has been flagged up very recently. You know, Kickstarters for role playing games are only looking for $30,000 or $40,000. To cover the cost of producing the games, turning around and getting 400,000 or more. Yeah. And you know, they'll create whole new structures for models for tabletop games or special editions of the book, which will only, you know, or improving the quality of the book as time goes on. I mean, what we did was we actually, as part of our stretch goals, we would offer free content to Kickstarter backers if they reach certain targets, and that would go out to all of our Kickstarter backers. We've actually got what is essentially a small book, which is going to be released in PDF format. We're toying with the idea of incorporating it into the complete volumes as well. And these, you know, this mini book will be released in parts as time goes on to help supplement the content you're seeing in the main book. And you know, the idea was you hit $30,000, you get the first 10 pages of this. You hit $40,000, you get this, the next 10. You know, little things like that, just to keep people interested and keep people pledging. But yeah, thinking back on what I would have done differently, given the opportunity, I'd kept it a bit more straightforward. I'd change the voiceover for sure in the video. And I wouldn't have offered the limited edition versions of the book, because that just made things a hell of a lot trickier than they needed to be.
Okay, Retro, do you want to ask your question? The final one of our questions.
Yeah, it's a slightly cheeky two-parter, since I'm curious about the second part. Do you want both at once?
Yeah, sure, why not?
Okay, right. Well, now, I know the general health of the comics industry has been on a bit of a downward trend over the last few years. I'm just wondering how much of a factor of that was going with Kickstarter.
Why do you think Kickstarter has actually directly negatively impacted the comics industry?
No, well, no, it's just I've seen sales just continue falling. In the comics industry over about the last 10 years, books that were selling, so many hundred thousand about a decade ago are now selling, you know, tens of thousands. So, was the problem, you know, with investment in an industry like that, one of the reasons to go to Kickstarter, cut out the middleman?
I think cutting out the middleman is very important. Factor for people who are looking to go to Kickstarter. You get a lot of people who in all likelihood would never have gotten their book published without going to Kickstarter. And to some extent, in spite of the fact we had a publisher, I don't think the outreach for Telecost would have necessarily been as large. This isn't a slight against Vanquish at all. This is more just a general fact with regards to the kind of book that we're creating and so on. You know, it's hard to get books solicited through Diamond Distribution and stuff like that. That's really hard for indies, really hard.
Exactly.
And, you know, as a small, you know, early endeavor by two individuals who have never made comics before, who have never released anything of any quantifiable note, to try and then go to Diamond and go, right, we've got this new book, it looks really good. Do you want to distribute it? And they're like, well, who's it written by? Well, it's just yeah. People, but yeah, he's a debut writer. Right, okay, well, who's the art by then? Well, it's by Adam Byrne, this debut artist.
And they go, right. I'll call you back.
Yeah, basically, you know. And you get so many people who have, you know, that people who have web comics, and they don't have the means to be able to set up an e-commerce site, for example.
Yeah.
You have people who are looking to make... they're already producing books and they're already selling them, but they don't necessarily have the investment to be able to go out and buy a big production run. So you see webcomics doing that a lot. And you see people who've been making books for some time going down that route too, looking to try and expand their production runs to such a way that they can save money and also deliver a cheaper book to people.
Yeah. You
know, basically passing on the savings to their pre-existing communities. And you see, and you also see people who, you know, aspiring comics artists who in all likelihood wouldn't get signed up by a publisher, who wouldn't get picked up because their stuff is too niche or the style of artwork isn't necessarily to everyone's liking. I mean, even Adam's artwork on Telecos, in spite of the fact that it's absolutely stunning, and it's really great artwork, there are plenty of people who have turned around and said, well, it's not traditional artwork, it's all digital. This isn't what I would want to buy. And that's fair enough. You know, it's just not what the broader market's looking for.
Which is such a shame, because Adam's artwork, because I've seen issue one, is just, it's fabulous. It's beautiful, really. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah.
It's been a pleasure working with Adam on this, and it's, you know, and having worked with Adam on film projects and stuff in the past, I knew the quality of the work that he can do. And I knew that he would turn around and deliver an absolutely stunning book. And I've written the book specifically to give him as many opportunities as possible to be able to show off, you know, and flex his artistic muscles. So, you know, I knew he'd develop something great, but you turn around to a publisher and say, right, well, it's a new book by new creators. Do you want to publish us? You know, people like Image and stuff like that. In spite of their indie cred and so on, they're probably not going to publish us.
They want more of a track record.
Because I remember looking at the, if you're unsolicited and you're trying to get the attention of Marvel, I was looking at their submission guidelines a couple of months back, and they're like, it's okay if you're unknown, but we'd prefer if you had a self-published product that you could send us for us to look at before we even consider you. So they already want you to have got out there and done something before you
are even considered. In the end, I mean, they need somebody who's it's all well and good having somebody that can draw really well, but if they have no experience in actually finishing a project, then it's pretty much meaningless.
It's a tough one.
And that can be an issue even with established artists and such.
Yeah, I mean, another kick-started project that I was aware of was Ashes, the follow-up to, I forgot what the book was. It was done by a friend of mine, and she was having some issues with her artist halfway through the Kickstarter. So it happens even when you're in the middle of doing this and trying to make it happen. That's just the nature of the business, and it's the nature of the product you're trying to create. You're trying to create something that's so rooted in creativity that this, you know, anything can happen. The same way that you can lose actors on a film set, and you can lose key staff from a games project. You know, it's just business. It happens.
And I think that's one thing. If we're going to open up the debate now a bit, I think that's one thing that Kickstarter have tried to get creators and make people who are supporting projects more aware of, the fact that they need to cut. Creators need to kind of say, look, stuff can go wrong, stuff can be delayed, and then to get supporters to kind of understand this isn't a shopping service. You know, it's a business product in a way that you're buying into, but just like any business, there's ups and downs and things that can delay and hinder production.
Well, I mean, it's a bit like replacing, say, for example, in Hollywood, you know, where you've got, you know, obviously the big companies funding films. It's a bit like replacing those, you know, funding people, you know, with actual kind of people that's giving you cash.
Yeah.
It's a bit like Wall Street.
I mean, and there are other crowdfunding services that are more about kind of like buying shares in a product. I know one got launched, so equity, basically. One, I think, got launched that was based in Europe earlier this year that was specifically targeted at games, which I talked about on something else. But I mean, as stuff that gets delayed in that, I've now backed, and I've got it written down, I've now backed 3 projects on Indiegogo. And I've backed 8 on Kickstarter since about August, September last year. Of those sort of 11 projects, I've seen stuff from 3. Not that I'm peeved and all that, because most of them have tended to keep people updated going, well, this is going on, this is why this has been delayed a bit. And some of them are things where I was only asking for I'd only put in a small amount of money, so I was only getting a small perk.
Yeah.
But, delivery can be a bit of a pain. But I think one of the things is that basically you've got a lot of people that are going on to Kickstarter and they don't necessarily have much business experience. So they don't have much project management experience, or budgeting experience, and so any of the sort of issues that they might encounter, they don't necessarily have the experience necessary to work around things. And certainly with the nature of some of the projects I've funded, I believe that has been an issue. They basically got people who just aren't used to doing their own thing, because it's like being self-employed, only a whole bunch of people have just commissioned you for something all in one go.
And one of the first pieces of advice that Kickstarter tells you when they have a little Kickstarter school that you you basically go through and you read, and once you read it you're then allowed to go onto the Kickstarter and actually build your appeal. But one of the first things they tell you is that when you're working out your reward structure, you must make sure that you can cover the cost of it.
Yeah.
Mm.
If you don't, you're screwed. And it's a valid point. It's a very valid point.
And I think it's a pretty basic
thing, but a lot of people seem to think, we'll just say we can do this, but they might not necessarily have costed it.
No. Well, that's happened with quite a few iOS game developers, hasn't it? Where they've gone in and created such a fund, but then realised that they've actually under-budgeted and had to find the funds in other means as well to get it out there.
In one of the ways that we went around trying to basically square ourselves away with that was to offer a lot of digital content.
Yeah.
Because fundamentally, digital content doesn't cost you anything. Yeah, you can email it if you want to.
I think that's I think that's certainly something that people are doing, books, comics, and games, definitely need to make sure they're doing, or even if it's a music album or something, is make sure they've got that digital sort of perks level.
Yeah.
Or else the whole thing's just going to fall apart. There's no way it will be successful in my eye at all, because
it's too big nowadays, isn't it?
It's not just that, but it's the cost, because it's not just the cost of producing it, but then if they're in the UK anyway, the postage is still going to be quite hefty, and if it's international, well, and don't forget that obviously if somebody from internationally has ordered one of your bigger perks and you've got a lot of stuff to bundle off to them, that's going to be some interesting shipping.
Yeah.
Good old DHL.
Actually, you hit on a really interesting thing with regards to postage, because one thing that, you know, I don't know if you're aware of this with UK postage, if you're trying to send something internationally and it's over 2 kilos, you have to send it with Parcel Force.
Yeah.
You can't send it Royal Mail. You used to be able to send off Royal Mail Parcel Post. It would cost like half the price of Parcel Force, but Royal Mail have reached the point where they just don't want to handle international post anymore. So if you're sending anything over 2 kilos, they're just not interested. They won't do it. You've got to send it with Parcel Force. And when you're trying to deliver on Kickstarter, you're making, I don't know, you could be making anything really, but if you have people asking for loads of little items, that can bundle up real quick. Next thing you know, you've got a massive issue trying to actually post the stuff out. And your costs that you initially listed as being, you know, please add $5 or please add $10 for this. You get to the end of it and it's, oh no, how am I supposed to pay 50 quid postage for this when I've only got 25 quid's worth of additional bonus money? So it's very odd. You know, there are all kinds of different factors that you may never even consider when you're putting Kickstarter
together. I think the lesson here then again is that people, if they're doing a project, they need to make sure they've got some very good scales handy and that they keep doing mock-ups of all the physical perks that they're offering and kind of combining them together and weighing them, and then weighing them obviously in the box that they will inevitably be sent off in, and just kind of, yeah, I could just imagine, and then have like its tariff sheet of postage costs, sort of international rates and stuff, just beside the scales.
Well, I mean, I think
that's just a nightmare.
I think the general point is that it's a bit like when kind of figuring out the budget for like a film. You have to kind of over budget to just incorporate any like additional costs that you may not see.
That's one piece of advice I've seen in a couple of places, saying that actually if the minimum asking amount that you go for your Kickstarter total or even Indiegogo or something, you make sure that you're asking for potentially more than you need so that you can cover unforeseen costs.
Yeah. I think one person said to me it's probably aim for about 10%.
Okay.
So say, for example, if you need £100 to finish a project, who would need £100 to finish a project like that?
Yeah.
But yeah, then you'd like ask for like an extra £10 obviously. Yeah.
You've also got to factor in the fact that Kickstarter and Indiegogo both, they actually take a cut of the money you raise.
Yeah.
So you've got to add an extra bonus. So even if you over budget, you then got to add an extra bonus to cover the cost that Kickstarter is going to take you off of you.
Yeah.
So, while it's all well and good saying, all right, look, we've got to raise as much as humanly possible. Yeah, at the same time, you've got to think, well, look, if you're doing something like Kickstarter where you've got the all or nothing, you've got to make sure that if you get the bare minimum, that you're not going to be suffering a massive financial kick in the teeth as a result of completing your thing. If you're going to do it, you've got to make sure that you don't suffer as a result of completion. In spite of any benefit you might have from completing it, you don't want to then have to pay out an extra 10 grand to be able to actually finish it.
I mean, if you obviously have something on Kickstarter, does that mean that your kind of future, like say for example, if you do a second project and you wanted to get on Kickstarter again, will your success of the previous project kind of help you, whereas the failure of your previous project would hold you back?
Your profile, as long as you set them up properly, they're quite public. If you look at, you find me on Kickstarter and it'll tell you how many I've backed. And I think if you're a creator, it does say how many you've created and how many you've backed and stuff. So I think if you've managed to be behind an unsuccessful project, I think it probably would come to bite you in the teeth, or bite you in the ass, basically.
I think there's actually another interesting difference there. You've got, on the one hand, the people who run a Kickstarter and they don't make the target. And on the other hand, you've got the people who make their target and don't deliver it.
I think it's that group.
Yeah.
Delivering is going to be disastrous for you.
Yeah.
Because that will haunt you. Because those people who backed you before, they'll see your Kickstarter again, especially if it's another impressive project and it gets on the front page and it does all that, but it's being done by someone who didn't actually follow through on a previous project. Everyone's going to flag you up and go, this guy must not be allowed to complete this project.
Yeah.
No, and they'll just shut it down.
Mm.
They've got to defend their own business, really, because it is, at the end of the day, their own business, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is. So. It's all right, though, because every once in a while they'll get a new year and they'll get several million dollars in the bank, so it's all fine. So to bring us back to the initial point of the question, which was a long time gone, investment from the industry is tough. You know, it's a tough industry to crack into, and Kickstarter gives a perfect outlet for people who are just trying to live the dream. And I think that it's a really healthy way of doing that. A lot of people are complaining about Kickstarter and they're saying that Kickstarter is bad for the industry. If it is bad for the industry, then at the very least it's good for creators.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd say that much.
Definitely.
Well, I think on that note that we're going to have to call it a night. Please, people, don't forget to enter a competition. We'll be putting details up on our site, and we'll be, I wouldn't say badgering, but we'll certainly be keeping you posted on Twitter and the like about it.
Yes.
And it's good night from...
Peter Cooper. You can find me on Twitter at Peter B. Cooper. And I'm sure you can stalk me on Facebook somewhere. Check out the Telecost Protocol Twitter as well, at Telecost Protocol, and also the Telecost Protocol Facebook page, facebook.com/Telecost Protocol.
Nice. It's good night from me, Paul Wood. I'm Retroid on Eurogamer.net and Super Retroid on Twitter.
And it's good night from me, Paul, aka OneArmed_Cookie. On Twitter, and you can also find me lurking around thegamejar.com.
Okay, it's good night from me, Paul Blewett, that's my Twitter handle, and I have a website, paul-blewett.com.
And it's good night from me, I'm Emily King, and you can find me on Twitter at ek6891, and I'll go on, you can go on my website as well, which is ek-creations.com. And you can find Nerd Assemble at www.nerdassemble.co.uk. You can also find us on Games Fiends these days as well at www.gamesfiends.com. We're also on Twitter at Nerds Podcast. You can find us on Facebook at Nerds Assemble Podcast and on Google Plus still. So it's good night from me.
And good night from Pete.
And good night from me.
And good night from me.
And good night from me too.
Good night.
Night.
Good night.